This is the State of Things from the Full Frame Theater at the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, you know, just a few decades ago, the place where we're sitting right now was the power plant fueling massive operations at the American Tobacco Company. The industry was in its heyday. Sales were booming. Durham was a bustling town. After Big Tobacco packed up and left Durham in the 80s, the facility sat shuttered and dark until 2004, when the revitalization of American Tobacco campus began. We're going to talk about that revitalization today, but first, I want to look back to the days when the building where we are sitting right now was far too noisy to do a radio show. And a man who worked here was Richard Clemens. He's an employee of American Tobacco through the years. He has experienced the highs and lows, and he has returned to the place where he worked for so many years. Rick, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And that is what they called you. They called you Rick when you were working here all those years.
Many things. They called me a lot of things. That was the one I went by. Yeah.
Your father and grandfather also worked here?
Yes.
How long were they working here?
My father was here 36 years. My grandfather, plus or minus 41 years, because he was in the Army at one point in time. And during that service, he did not work here.
You almost broke the chain because you had it in your head that you were going to be an artist, right?
That's correct. I was in college, Chowan Junior College up in Murfreesboro, and had decided on media art. That was going to be my future. And I received a phone call one morning, 7:30, came in the dorm. I knew I was in trouble. Anytime you get a call from a parent. And my dad told me, pretty blunt, he said, "Ben Roberts wants to speak to you today at noon." And I was three and a half hours away at that point in time. So as I told you, I grabbed the four corners of my sheets. I made it into a suitcase with all my clothes on them, threw them in the car, never looked back. And I was here for my interview with Ben Roberts that day.
All right, why was that such exciting news to you that you had an application waiting for you at this plant?
Because at that point in time in the 70s, $13 an hour, $15 an hour was unheard of. I mean, and to have that opportunity and to watch what my father had done in the years he was there and the comfort and the way our family came up, I knew that it was my opportunity to go for it, and that's what I had to do.
So tell us about the jobs you had here. What did you do here?
I started out as a stocker, which was what we did was supplied the machines that made cigarettes with the filter material, the rolls of paper, the actual components that made up the cigarettes, and I was to supply the machines for those.
And then you did that. You described something that they used to do right over where Tyler's is right now. Mm-hmm. Describe those, the units of, I guess they were cylinders, right?
Cylinders, hogsets are what we called them. They were cylinders of tobacco that had a top and bottom made out of wood and then a large wrap that was made out of wood and wire, almost like a picket fence that wrapped around the tobacco. And at that station, we stripped the tobacco hogsets off, which left us just a large cylinder of tobacco, and then we penetrated the tobacco with steam, and that steam was to kill any insects or anything else that might be in the tobacco before we manufactured with it.
And I'm told that the way this town smelled, especially when the trains rolled in, was pretty indescribable. Huh?
It was, and the interesting thing about it, after a period of time, you didn't smell it anymore. It was like I told you earlier, if secondhand smoke were going to kill people, we'd all be gone.
I mean, they issued free cigarettes, right?
Sure. Every entrance to the bathrooms, every entrance to the locker rooms, the entrance to the cafeteria, there were cigarette dispensers on the wall that had fresh cigarettes, and you could walk by and pull one off like a cup of water, you know.
I guess that's one perk I could do without, but I take your point.
Yeah.
It was kind of a lovely thing at the time. You were also a watchman, right?
Mm-hmm. I did night watchman here. It was an opportunity to make more money. I worked different shifts as a night watchman, and you did an entire walk of this facility four times in an eight-hour period.
You got a story you tell about a gentleman who broke you in. I think you're a mentor in the
Watchman. He was a tall, skinny guy, wore bibbed overalls all the time and T-shirts, and I followed him for the first week, and we walked this entire place, and I mean, it's a large area. And when we would get to the office, which was the white building on the left corner up at the top, he would become rigid like a soldier and march through the two floors that we worked at. And for a week, I watched him do this, and I was like, what is it with that? What are you doing? And so finally, I got the nerve to ask him, and he told me, he goes, Ricky, they've put cameras in the office. I was good with that. Until I realized, he said, they're on the tables, don't look at them. So, they were electric pencil sharpeners. This is what had, in coming to pass, they placed them on the secretary's desk. And so, the night I finally stuck the pencil in one, I thought I was going to have to revive him. That's one of the many things that have gone on behind the doors here.
High tech comes to American Tobacco. So
exactly.
Also, this was a town that was, because there were people, there were working people with money, there was a nightlife in this town.
Oh, sure. We, across from where the police station is now, Mr. Studevant had a hotel complex there. Before it was that, it was a thriving hotel motel and had a disco there. And this was in the disco era, 1974. Disco started out big there, Discoville, and then Disco 76. And the employees here were bouncers, managers, and so forth over at the disco. So we were able to, that's where we entertained ourselves when we didn't entertain ourselves here. So it was
a couple times you had to ask your dad for lunch money.
Every day. Every day. I met my dad on the walkway where Tyler's is located now, and he was a pipe fitter here. He was a plumber and then a supervisor. And being a young guy, you know how it is, you never have money after Monday. So I always hit him up for lunch money at that same location every day.
You'd think he'd be smart enough to not show up. But
he funny you said that, because he worked here 40, all told, and we did some calculation. He did 36 years here and missed 3 days, and he broke his arm here and only missed 3 days' work. He came in with his cast on and went right back to plumbing. Wow. It was incredible. Wow. So growing up with him, living in the same house, there was never a question of, well, am I going to go to work today? I just don't feel that good. It was, get your you-know-what out of here, let's go. I'm waiting for you, you know, and I rode to work with him every day, so...
What was it like when you got word they were going to close this place?
It was devastating. I mean, we didn't know what to do. It was, it wasn't just a job for us. It was like a community coming together. We were a large family, and we knew that, you know, the dream was over, so to speak. And it was a tough deal to be making that type of money, which, you know, I'm very proud of because of what we accomplished. But to have that taken out from under you and kind of jerked out from under your feet was a big blow to this city, not only to the individuals who were the employees here, but the city as a whole, because between ourselves and the other tobacco company and Duke University, at that point in time, they were big three. We were the three largest employers in Durham. And to have that go away, I mean, I think if anyone has been here through the 80s, they know what changes Durham went through at that point in time. And to see it now resurrect, it feels like, I don't know, it feels like we can close the book. Kind of.
Well, let me ask you that in particular. What's it like for you to walk back through this place now looking the way it does today?
Oh, it's bittersweet. Being able to have the opportunity to actually help with the rebuild and to be able to come in. I work in the communications industry now, so I got to come in and actually take part in some of the revitalization. It's a great feeling to me because, as I mentioned earlier, seeing a parking lot with grass in it, that's tough. Mm-hmm. Tough deal.
Well, now there's plenty of cars in there.
Yeah.
If that's making you happier.
Well, there are no cars. It's a baseball field, actually.
Rick, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much. Rick Clemons, an employee of American Tobacco. More than 15 years. We've got some photos of Richard's collection at American Tobacco. He's brought a lot with us, but you can see all of it at our website, stateofthings.org. We're going to talk about that redevelopment and how things came back after the 1980s when things closed. We're going to hear from Jim Goodman and many others. First, we've got the music of Dan McGee of Chapel Hill-based band Spider Bags on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll be right back. Here's Dan McGee. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Full Frame Theater at American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Thank you. Well, today we're talking about the redevelopment of Durham. You just heard that remarkable story that Rick Clemons told about working here, about how bad it felt when this place closed and Durham started to decline. And things came back, and a lot of folks said it couldn't happen. Jim Goodman was the driving force behind much of that effort in downtown Durham, including the American Tobacco Historic Campus, where we are sitting today. He took that revitalization effort on in 2004, and a lot of people thought it was a doomed effort. But the thriving businesses and retail spaces a decade later show that that's just not true. Jim Goodman is the CEO of Capital Broadcasting and joins us on the State of Things. Good to have you here, Jim. Thank you so much.
I feel like I'm on with the Music Prairie Home Companion.
This is, that's right.
That's great. Right. An audience, music.
Jim,
we're glad to be here.
On the program today. So we're talking about the 10-year anniversary of this facility,
right.
But really, I suppose the story goes back to 1995 with the Durham Bulls and that new stadium, huh? I mean, tell us about that, because that was another, they said it couldn't be done. That was, there was a lot of tension over whether to put that here. There was a question of whether to go to Raleigh, right?
I had, you know, we had the U.S. Olympic Festival here, and I noticed it's the first time we ever had the Chambers of Commerce working. We had 14,000 volunteers to run the festival. They had it all over the triangle. And so I got this big notion that what we need is a triangle sports park. Triangle Central Park, optioned land out by the airport, and my idea was that we would have the arena, we'd have the convention center, we'd have everything in this Triangle Central Park. And in order to get that done, I needed an anchor tenant, and tried to talk Miles Wolf, the Bulls owner at the time, into moving the team to Triangle Central Park. Now, by the way, Triangle Central Park, there was some land in Raleigh and Cary and Durham. Mm-hmm. As I say, we weren't going to Indianapolis. It was 4 or 5 miles that way. So now, meantime, Durham comes up with a plan to build a new stadium and to do some redevelopment in American Tobacco, and they put it to a vote, and the vote failed. The citizens voted against the new stadium and American Tobacco, and I think Miles was very discouraged. And so I figured that if I was going to get the Bulls to be the anchor tenant at Triangle Central Park, I'd have to own them. So I bought the team from Miles. He was happy to sell. I mean, he was disappointed, and I was happy to buy it, and he was happy to sell it. And I remember the restaurant we went to. But anyhow, okay, so Raleigh has the plans. We bid out the project. We select a contractor, and we're ready to build the stadium in Triangle Central Park. Now, Durham, the Durham city manager, Orville Powell, and the folks in Durham were very upset about that. And Mayor Upchurch in Raleigh, who just the nicest person you'll ever meet, it just couldn't stand it if anybody was mad at him. So he called up the mayor of Durham and said, well, y'all voted against this. Now, we're willing to build them a stadium. You're not, so what are you mad about? And the mayor of Durham said, well, give us 30 days. Maybe we will. And we all thought, you know, they voted against it. So within that 30 days, Durham agreed, the city council, to mortgage the sewer plant and build a ballpark.
Wow.
And you know, you got to play the cards you're dealt, right? So I ended up with a great new ballpark in downtown Durham. Didn't get my sort of dream Triangle Central Park going, but this has really come out well. Durham built a great ballpark. We've had a great relationship with them now. And when they built it, when they agreed to build it, I said, okay, guys, now I will try. If you'll help me, I'll try to make this investment in the ballpark pay off. I think we can probably do some development around the park. I mean, I don't know for sure, but let's get this park done, and we'll see if we can't make all this go. I mean, that was a commitment I made right from the beginning, and we got right on it.
And you were imagining then this facility. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, they were doing SWAT team practice here.
A lot of money in that.
During the ball games, the gases and all would come over into the ballpark. I figured I needed to do it to save everybody. No,
that's all you need.
No,
is gunshots and
no.
Sirens, and while the game's going on.
No, the answer to your question is no. I didn't really have a vision for American Tobacco, but I knew I could put three buildings around the ballpark: Diamond View One, Diamond View Two, and Diamond View Three. So we kept, you know, you come to the games and you see what's going on, and you look at American Tobacco, and you keep seeing it, and you say, well, we're very successful with our first Diamond View One. I said, well, let's. Can we come up with a way to do this that makes sense? And the way that came up with was we optioned the property. Had a long option, got the option from Adam Abrams, and then went about seeing if we could get other folks to participate with us in terms of doing the project. And the first was to go to the city and the county and say, okay, I've got this optioned. I don't know whether I can do this or not, but if I can get tenants, will you all build the parking decks? To which they said, yes. And then I don't know whether they thought they were committing anything or not.
Well, the cheaper answer would have been no.
Right. Yeah. Well, no. And so then I talked to Duke, I talked to Glaxo, I talked to McKinney, and I talked to these companies, and they all shared the vision we had about a revitalized American Tobacco. So I was able to lease out a good bit of the property and have the commitment on the decks. And it took a lot of time, but it was a very planned out and phased deal, and it came out just fine.
I'd like to know what part vision and what part kind of market research goes into this, because I've heard you say vision several times, and what people if you just recently come to Durham, it would be hard to envision a commercial success here 20 years ago, and people would talk you out of it. So how much of this was a kind of a heartfelt vision, and how much real data and market research did you do before you got partners on board?
Right. We did no research. Mike Hill, our general counsel, and I would call Mike our lead developer, who really put all this together and was the workhorse here. I never will forget. We were leaving the ball game one night, and I said, Mike, I think you should call Adam and get an option on American Tobacco. He said, what for? I said, well, we might want to try it. And he said, oh, no. But we got the option and went through it. I mean, it was a vision of what it could be. You know, Frank, Durham was in a situation that I thought was very interesting. You know, they would produce surveys that would say, you know, we're not nearly as bad as people say we are. I mean, it just sort of a complex about something and what I saw was a wonderfully diverse, great place to be. And so I didn't have all that baggage about mm-hmm. how people treat everybody so bad over here. So I didn't have that. I just went ahead like this is going to work, and we made her happen. And I think, I believe. What are you happy about, Jim? I think that what American Tobacco has done and the ballpark and everything else has made Durham realize what a great place this is and has given a lot of people ideas about doing more and more. I think it's a good start. There are great things happening.
Yeah. Well, let's get kind of a broader picture of maybe how that happened, because all of this seemed to be in Jim's head, and it did come out on the ground, and it's playing out right before our very eyes. Redevelopment of a downtown like Durham is really only one example in the Triangle. Wake County just celebrated the birth of its millionth resident. The growth and development can bring vitality to communities, not without challenges, obviously. But I think, as Jim said, you know, stuff begets stuff. And when you see what can be done and when a few leaders have a vision and it starts to blossom, other folks begin to imagine other possibilities. And I think that's what we're seeing here in the area. So to get a sense of how this has happened and how it may happen in the future, we've invited Jason DeBruin. Jason's a reporter for the Triangle Business Journal. Welcome, Jason. Good to have you back on the program. Mai Nguyen is with us. She's a professor of city and regional planning, I should say, at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Mai Nguyen, thank you. And Christopher Gergen is CEO of Forward Impact and the founder of Bull City Forward. Christopher, good to see you as well. Let me start with you. You started Bull City Forward in the city, which had a vision of its own. Why? What was Bull City Forward all about?
Well, it's interesting. Bull City Forward came together, and Jim mentioned the importance of collective impact. You know, it's the idea of vision, but then making sure that you've got a lot of other people behind sharing that vision. Bull City Forward came about because a number of people were starting to talk about this idea of how Durham was really starting to signify this concept of social innovation. How do we actually look at economic development that is also having a positive social good, positive community good? And so some of these conversations were beginning to bubble where we were saying, how do we help to make Durham a city where innovation never sleeps? Was sort of the rallying cry behind this work. And so we slowly pulled together a group of actually 400 people got involved in the planning process behind Bull City Forward to think about what were the key levers to pull to try to think about how do you create a robust innovation ecosystem in the context of Durham. And so we went and looked at 13 different cities around the world that we thought were doing an interesting job building out their own respective entrepreneurial ecosystems. We looked at some of the research that was going on. And we pulled that back into our own community and said, okay, based upon what we saw as five levers of change, how are we doing against those? And we mapped out where we thought the gaps were. And we started to develop a plan for trying to address those gaps under the umbrella of Bull City Forward.
Wait, what are those five levers?
So it's thinking about how are we doing with regards to our talent development? So how are we home growing our talent? How are we recruiting it? And how are we retaining it? So that's the build piece of this. You need a density of talent. Second is, are you creating a robust enabling environment to be able to connect these emerging problem solvers and innovators with the resources and relationships they need to be successful? And there's a number of examples of that. The third is, are we measuring the impact that these folks are actually having, both economic impact and community impact? Because without data, it's hard to then affect the fourth lever, which is policy, and trying to think about how is economic and community development policy aligned with this concept of innovation ecosystem. And then the fifth is, how well are we telling these stories, right? There's so many amazing things. I agree with Jim in the fact that Durham had a different reputation for years and years and years. And the question is, how do you change that story? How do you change the narrative and celebrate some of the amazing things that are going on? So those are the five levers. And we started looking at each of those and trying to think about ways that we could close the gaps and try to accelerate the innovation ecosystem, and that was the birth of Bull City Forward.
My win, Jim talked about working with the city and the county, getting a couple of fortuitous yeses at just the right moment. What is the relationship between the business community and the, you know, the sort of the political infrastructure? What part do they play, and how do they play together?
Yeah, there's a lot of collaboration that needs to happen, but I mean, I just want to take a step back and think about RTP in the 1950s. I think that was, you know, sowing the seeds for redevelopment today. This area is much different than other regions in that we are a sprawling metropolis. I mean, Chapel Hill, Durham, Raleigh. I mean, the patterns of growth are actually sprawling and growing farther and farther out. And so downtown redevelopment goes against this tide of growth patterns. And so in order for that to happen, it takes very strong collaboration between the public and private sector. So when listening to Jim talk about, you know, having this vision, and it's sort of all just work together, well, actually, there's a lot of planning in place to make that happen, right? So the city of Durham, for example, had to say, we're going to use our tax monies to actually build parking lot, two parking lots for American Tobacco to actually happen. He had to get anchor tenants to agree to move in there in order to make the financing happen. So it's public and private sector layering all of these resources in order to make the numbers work. And so it's a concerted effort, a planning effort, a economic development effort.
Jason DeBruin, Maya's talking about the infrastructure that was already here. There was a robust economy. It may not have been in downtown Durham at the moment, but with RTP, having been here for so long, there was money, there was economic activity. Give us a sense, a kind of an economic financial picture of Durham over the last, with this area over the last couple of decades.
Oh, well, it's definitely grown, no question about that. And if I could take also a step back real quick and first mention that I think a big reason for some of the growth is we have a number of catalysts that have sort of really spurned more industries, and I'll give you three quick examples. The first one being Jim Goodnight, not Jim Goodman, but Jim Goodnight, who graduated from NC State University and founded SAS Institute. He sort of was a forward thinker in that this big data analytics was going to be something that everybody was going to want, going to need, and that there was going to be a big business need for it. Certainly he was right. SAS is now a $2 billion-plus company headquartered right here in Cary. that's drawn a lot of other tech companies our way. Similarly, we had two contract or clinical research organizations that spun out of UNC Chapel Hill, one being Quintiles by Dennis Gillings, the other being PPD, that was Fred Eshelman. Both of those also grew into major, you know, pharmaceutical services companies that then were able to attract other companies to this area, have other CROs start. So I think when you have sort of these examples of companies that started locally here but really grew into these really big mega companies, that's really important because then that allows RTP to sort of flourish. Because by SAS staying here, by Quintiles staying here, PPD mostly here, also in Wilmington, it attracts other companies who want to be closer to those companies because they can get talent from those companies, A, but also collaborate with them, B, and then that sort of, as you mentioned, stuff begets stuff. That's true. I mean, it sort of ends up building on itself. That allows RTP to be successful, and then that allows the Triangle, Durham, Raleigh, all parts to be successful.
And, of course, the point is when it comes to development, whether it's Goodnight or Goodman, it's all good. I mean,
your point is well taken, I think. And of course,
call me Mr. Goodnight all the time. And when he owned Midway Airlines, they would say, are you Jim Goodnight? And I'd say, yes, my airline is not safe. You better not fly.
Well, Frank,
can
yeah,
I?
Yeah,
I
please do. Please do.
Okay, so there are two things that I wanted to mention. When I went to work for Capital Broadcasting in the early 70s, several of you have heard me say this, this market, the Raleigh-Durham market, was the 63rd ranked market in the country in terms of the number of TV households in this market in our counties. We were 63rd in the country. In the last rating period, this market was the 24th market. And in this market, now, anybody know who 25 is? Charlotte.
Way to go.
I knew we were doing it.
Jim, okay, Goodman, but CEO of Capital Broadcasting at 30 seconds.
Okay, 30
seconds. Then we're going to come back.
But, okay, Raleigh's not the 24th market. Durham's not the 24th market. Chapel Hill's not the 24th market. Cary's not the 24th market. We're the 24th market when we are all together. See, that's the whole point of this region being such a dominant force if we hang together.
We're going to find out how we can do that even more, particularly through the arts, when our conversation continues with Jim Goodman, the CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company, who helped redevelop American Tobacco, Jason DeBruin, reporter for the Triangle Business Journal, My Win, professor of city and regional planning at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Christopher Gergen is CEO of Forward Impact and the founder of Bull City Forward. We're going to continue our conversation in a moment, but first, more music from Dan McGee. Dan. Thank you. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about the development in the Triangle. Population expansion and new businesses bring concrete changes to this region. But this type of growth also changes the way we live, particularly in the world of arts and culture. They both have an impact on each other, the way we live, arts and culture, on the development of this area. So joining our conversation now is Liza Roberts. She's editor and general manager of Walter Magazine, which covers the arts, culture, and people of Raleigh. Welcome, Liza.
Thank you.
So we've talked a lot about some of the economic factors, financial factors, and political. What role, if any, do arts and culture play in all of this?
I think it's a huge role, and a role that is sometimes underestimated. You've said in a couple of different conversations today that stuff begets stuff as development occurs. Art certainly begets art, but not only that, it begets community. And I think that that is empirically true. It's also true that arts are a major industry in the Triangle. It's not just feel-good stuff. It's a real industry of about $144, $145 million. Support about 6,000 jobs. This is just in Raleigh alone, larger Triangle-wide. We've got music festivals that are increasingly popular coming to Raleigh and the Triangle. The IBMA, the World of Bluegrass, is coming next month.
Stop there just for a minute and talk about that. IBMA, the International Bluegrass Music Association, had its annual conference for years in Nashville, the one with the N, not the A, and they moved here to Raleigh, and then after 1 year here, signed a six-year contract to come back for the next 6 years. What was behind that? What happened? Why?
Well, I think a lot of things happened. I think, first of all, it was much more broadly attended than was expected. There was also really an electricity in the air around that festival last year. There was a real sense of community, almost a homespun kind of hospitality that Raleigh brought to the picture that was organic, and I think the musicians and the audiences really appreciated. I know Chatham County Line, a homegrown Raleigh bluegrass band, is playing here tomorrow. They have a new song out that basically is all about how absolutely thrilled they are, and they're pinching themselves with excitement that this is now going to be a six-year gig. It's called Bluegrass is Living in Raleigh Now.
Wow. Well, tell us about that hospitality, because it played out in really material ways, including the volunteers who were, like, bringing food, right?
Oh, yeah. There were thousands of them who signed up, and they brought hot coffee into the wee hours. They made casseroles and brownies. And
casseroles. Isn't that great? That's so perfect.
No, really, it was truly a homespun effort.
And Jim Goodman, I mean, music and the arts have been a part of the development of this area as well, the concerts on the lawn here. Was that part of the vision from the beginning?
Right, with the lawn. Of course, the theater has added mightily to the district. This is my experience of recruiting companies to come to the Triangle and hopefully get them here, but certainly get them to the Triangle, is the HR manager is more involved than anybody else. And the HR manager says, okay, where are my employees going to live? What is it like to live here? What is the quality of life? What are the schools like? What is the arts community? What are the recreation opportunities? People really care about where they live, and they spend a lot of time looking at what we have in the Triangle. I don't think I'm going too far when I say there's a New Jersey organization, a large national organization that we recruited to the Triangle. Didn't get them here, but we got them to the Triangle. I maintain it's because I called Larry Wheeler at the Art Museum. Said, Larry, I'm sending these guys over for lunch, and they're not leaving the Art Museum until you talk them into coming to the Triangle. I didn't go. Michael and I didn't go. We didn't, and they went there. They came out and said, you know, nobody has talk to us about that, and they decided to come here. And I want to just, I've never had any company ask me about the unemployment tax rate. Mm-hmm. I've never had any company ask me about the corporate income tax rate. This stuff they're doing down there,
We were number one in recruiting businesses when the tax rate was so high, so you wonder if it won't broke by
well, that's not, but my point is, you understand my point. I mean,
I put that. I had air quotes around the house.
Yeah, I know. But that really so. And what Richard Florida told us, which I found remarkable now, is that most people decide where they're going to live before they get a job. I didn't grow up with that. You know, I grew up with you move with your company and you go where the job is. Now they decide where they want to live. They take a look at our communities and how vital they are and how much fun it is to live here, and they move here without a job. Right, that's the way it works. And so that's where we need to be making our investments is in infrastructure.
Krister?
Yeah, can I just add to that, which is this idea of talent retention? So we have an amazing, one of the other things that makes this region so special, of course, is our university system and our community college system. We have this amazing talent base, but we also have had a huge talent exodus every May. And so the real question and trick for us is figuring out a way that we can actually retain a lot of that talent and figuring out ways that we can create really robust environments that young people want to stay part of. The arts are a big part of that. The food community is a huge part of that. The fact that they can go to a local farmer's market and get local arugula that's made out of these. I mean, all of these things make a huge difference. And I think it's keeping our talent in a meaningful way in this community, which is not only about recruiting new companies, but actually being able to keep our talent here, which is so exciting.
So, Mai Nguyen, did we just get lucky? We've got a visionary who's in the vanguard. He starts the stuff rolling, and then, you know, people like Christopher can come in and say, well, I can organize some of these folks around this stuff. Are you just getting lucky, or is there a way then you can build political infrastructure and do the kind of planning to make this happen quite intentionally?
No, this isn't luck. It's quite intentional. I mean, it takes, the one good thing about this area is population growth, right? So that's driving a lot of the demand of housing and retail and restaurants, right? So unlike Buffalo, which you talked about earlier, which they're losing population, right? So that's what we have going for this area, demographic shifts. And the demographic shifts are showing, when you look at who's moving here, it's also people, young people, who want the experience of living in a cool place, right? So they're not moving here to make large amounts of money, although some of them do, but it's a different type of individual moving to this region. And then it takes city and county governments to really think through how they want to support the private sector, right? So the city of Durham and the county of Durham has actually provided lots of incentives to developers in order to get projects moving off the ground. I mean, hotels, lots of different rehabilitation projects, and then having having tax incentives here also. So Durham actually created a historic district in the downtown so that it was an incentive for investors to come in, rehabilitate these historic buildings, and reduce their risk. I mean, rehabilitation is a risky endeavor. That's why not a lot of people do it, right? So if government can reduce that risk, you'll bring in lots more investors.
We're talking about redevelopment, but really when we picture this, it's a lot of people who come to it with some wealth, with some options. If you can really move without a job, you've got lots of options. Are all boats rising? Are we bringing everybody along? And how do you do that if we're not?
No, we aren't. That's actually a really good point that you should bring up. Let me point out a couple numbers. So in the Triangle, we've probably grown a population growth since 2010 of about 7-8%. Compare that to North Carolina of only about 3%. So more than double the rate of growth in population alone since 2010. However, the homeownership rate across the state is roughly 67%. So you're looking at more than two-thirds of the residents in any particular area own their own home, whereas in Raleigh, it's closer to 54%, and in Durham, it's even lower at 50%. Now, is that necessarily a bad thing? No, we're drawing young professionals, but it also means that these people aren't as tied to this area as they might otherwise be. So if a better job comes along in San Francisco, Austin, the Bay Area, wherever, you know, pick your favorite city for young professionals, it's much easier for them to pick up and go. Another problem that we're seeing, and this is probably a nationwide problem as much as anything, but we're seeing a difference in a wage gap where the average wages, you see them going up at a pretty steady clip, but the median wage is sort of staying roughly stagnant. So you're seeing the top end earners are the ones that are really ending up making more, whereas the average worker isn't Sure, the wages are going up. I mean, it's shown in the data, but it's not going up at near the clip that it is for some of the high-end earners. And these are some of the things that we definitely need to be thinking about as a community. It's easy to sort of hang our hat on population growth and this company's hiring and that company's hiring, but we do have other issues that we need to make sure that we work through and that we're thinking about so that we don't turn around in 10 years and scratch our heads and go, well, why are all the young people gone? 10 years ago, we were this great place.
Yeah. Mai?
Yeah, I wanted to add to that. I mean, I think that's a great point in that the city of Durham has done a great job of redevelopment. Now they have to think 20 years to the future and say, how are we going to have less congestion and less sprawl? That might require affordable housing in the downtown. That might require using some of these tax revenues that they've gotten from redevelopment towards more social endeavors so that we don't have the problems that these big cities elsewhere have, like traffic congestion, high housing prices, rising inequality, which is a trend in major cities in the U.S. So I think that the city needs to think longer term and address some of these issues.
Christopher, are you going to say?
Yeah, I would just add one more thing in terms of this idea of inclusive innovation. So we talk about these idea of innovation ecosystems. The question is, how do we actually extend that into communities that have traditionally been left behind, like Jason was talking about? One of the exciting things that came out 2 years ago is that Durham made a bid for the Bloomberg Challenge, and it was led by the mayor and the city manager, and we got all the way to the finals around this concept of proof of concept centers to be able to connect emerging problem solvers from our traditionally disenfranchised and underrepresented communities to be able to help stimulate entrepreneurial activity within East Durham, for example, or Southeast Durham. And so I think that there's some really promising things on the horizon. There's some amazing things that the Goodmans have been very supportive of in East Durham Children's Initiative, for example. And I'd love to be able to see more of that starting to happen as well, as Mai suggested, looking forward 20 years.
Well, Jim Goodman, let me ask you, as a business proposition, I mean, it's one thing to say, look, I need to have a successful business. I'm taking enough risk moving into a place where people aren't yet. Can you afford to have that kind of extra layer of responsibility? I need to bring everybody along and still be a successful business person?
Sure. Yeah, I think you can. I mean, there's no I need to be clear that I believe an advantage we had here is one of time. In other words, we weren't in a financing position that we could pay for what we were doing. So we weren't in a financing position that we had to finish at a certain time. So we had the time to bring everybody along and to do that. And that's certainly a doable proposition.
So that suggests that investment is good, but you need, again, if you are borrowing at 8, 9, 10%, that's bleeding you crazy, and you have to work fast to get a fast dollar. You might have to leave people behind. So slow money.
You need time.
You need
patient
time.
Capital. And patient capital, slow capital. Money, whatever you call it. Liza, I want to go back to the arts a little bit because often we hear that the first people forced out are the artists. They bring everybody in, and then, boom, they're gone because they were too successful. Is that happening?
Yes, sir. It doesn't seem to be happening at all. I think the opposite is the case. I think that artists are attracting other artists. I think that artists are creating jobs. I also think that in terms of things being democratically available to a wider audience, the Triangle does a remarkable job of having an incredibly high level of excellence in our cultural offerings, combined with a high level of accessibility. You can get to all of these things. A lot of them are free. Our museums, our state museums are all free, and they're some of the best in the country. Our symphony, our ballet, our opera companies, all of the music we just talked about, it's accessible. The Bluegrass Festival, just because we were talking about that, their street festival portion is free. There's a tradition in Chapel Hill, in Durham, and in Raleigh, all of having free outdoor music festivals and arts festivals. And they're regularly occurring. You don't need to pay anything to go with your family to go and be exposed to poetry and music and visual art and all kinds of things that are enriching. And I think that has a lot to do with what ties people to a community.
And don't forget, I never will forget this call. Like, we were recruiting an organization from Chicago as a part of Sears. And the HR manager called up and said, tell me about public TV and public radio in your area. No.
What'd you tell him, Jim?
I said, I said, except from noon to one, we're really good. No, so we had, in terms of I'm responding to your concept of excellence, that we have probably the top public radio station in the country, and we have a remarkably good statewide public TV system, and that's very important to economic development. That's what we got to keep talking about.
Call 877-962-9862. We're out of time. I want to thank all of you. I wish we had more time. But thank you all very much for being on the program. Liza Roberts, editor, general manager of Walter Magazine. Jason DeBruin, reporter for the Triangle Business Journal. Mai Nguyen, professor of city and regional planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Christopher Gergen, the CEO of Forward Impact and the founder of Bull City Forward. And Jim Goodman, CEO of Capital Broadcasting. Thank you for being on the program. Dan McGee is going to play us out. He's the front man for the local band Spider Bags. Some of the great art seen here on Merge Records, a local label. Their latest album is Frozen Letter. And Dan McGee, thank you so much for being on the program. And will you play us out?
Thank you.
Crazy friends, and
take it with you when you're gone.